I mean, L. Kirk Nurmi, everybody, is Jody Arias' forced defense lawyer. How many times did this guy try to get off the trial?
Well, I'm not saying that I wanted off the case because I thought she was guilty. What I'm saying is I wanted off the case because I had a sense of what it would become in terms of the media exposure, in terms of what she was going to do. And I didn't want to be a part of it. I didn't want to do capital work anymore.
Got
I wanted
it.
To move into private practice.
Got it.
I do remember, as I testified to this, I'm sorry, I think I would have testified to this in the 2014 trial. I do remember the moment when the knife went into Travis's throat and he was conscious. He was still trying to attack me. It was I who was trying to get away, not Travis, and I finally did. I never wanted it to be that way, Judge.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is your host, Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and currently writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today from London is...
Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst at New Scotland Yard and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
And with us today from Arizona is a very special guest.
Morning, Jim. It's Kirk Nurmi, a former defense attorney and current life coach and author.
Well, it's great to have you with us, Kirk. Today, we'd like to talk to you about a variety of topics, but probably one of the most infamous cases that you worked, the defense of Jody Arias in the murder of Travis Alexander. How long did you work that case?
I received that case in 2009. I was working in the Capital Unit of the Public Defender's Office, and it was essentially assigned to me there after the prior Public Defense Agency had a conflict of interest that prevented them from continuing their representation in this area. So when I got the case, it was a little over a year old, so to speak.
So what did you know about Jody Arias or the case when you first got called in?
When my supervisor first handed me the file, I didn't know a lot. Obviously, one thing that was immediately of note before I really investigated anything about the case was the fact that it was a female. A female defendant in a capital situation is exceedingly rare. I'm sure there's statistics somewhere, but I know common sense is enough to bear that out, that most facing the death penalty are men. So that was the immediate distinction, I guess, of the case right off the bat. From that point, though, at that time, given, like I said, it was about a year old, I was aware of the CBS special that she had done. I think it was 48 hours where she had done an interview. So I immediately went to seek out that video so I could kind of get a sense of who my new client truly was.
Can I ask a question, Kirk? Is that quite unusual for someone to do 48 hours or a show like that when they're on trial for murder of somebody?
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, I guess part of that deals with the fact that maybe the media is only interested in certain cases and only makes so many inquiries. But what was of note, I guess, in this case is that what we found later on is there was interviews. She was arrested in her hometown of Yreka. Interviews took place before she was even extradited to Arizona. So the first interview took place in Yreka when she was in the jail, and then a subsequent interview took place a few months later when she was, after she'd been extradited and was in custody in Maricopa County.
I can't imagine that her public defender would have wanted her to do that. I mean, did she do that without counsel or?
Well, there's a couple different tacks on that question. The first one is when she was in California, she had counsel, but that counsel was assigned to deal with the extradition issues. How much experience that person would have with criminal defense work, I have no insight on. But what I did know and what I wrote about in my book is this idea that I knew the prior attorney. And while I didn't know the conflict that we were talking about, I knew this prior attorney and I knew that she was very experienced in capital litigation And no defense attorney, quite frankly, especially in a capital sense, would advise their client to make more statements on videotape.
It was a very interesting development, and it only served to fuel the fire, didn't it? I mean, it just made this trial even more of a circus than it might have been, just because of the fact that it was a woman on trial for a death penalty offense, right?
I think so. I think that media attention that got onto it right away before she was even extradited really played a part in that growing attention and then the subsequent interviews. You know, just as by way of analogy, there was another case in Maricopa County about the same time of a woman who had killed a man, and there it was every bit as lurid, if not more so, than Miss Arias's case. But that essentially got no attention. The ball was already rolling down the hill when I got the case.
What can you tell us about Jodi Arias before this trial? What was she like? What was going on with her relationship with Travis?
Well, you know, we saw, I think one of the biggest things, and I'm glad you asked that, Jim, one of the biggest things that I always like to bring up with this case is that this is such a tragedy. We had two young people, a young woman who was struggling to find her way in the world and a beloved young man who was, in essence, doing the same. And we found this toxic bond, this toxic relationship that neither seemed to be able to break. They seemed to, you know, some you could call it a love-hate relationship, perhaps, because we saw a lot of love expressed and a lot of anger expressed within the relationship. But the word I always tend to use is chaos. And for whatever reason, they just could not find a way to separate from each other. And that's what got us to the point of the tragic circumstances of June 4th. 2008.
One of the things, as I recall, when the trial approached and when you were picking juries and everything was really kind of coming to a head, was that there was definitely a concerted effort on the part of the media to draw an audience. It was almost like advertising for a new TV show coming up. It was obvious that there was going to be a tremendous amount of day-to-day coverage. And I think it, I don't know, did it actually even eclipse the O.J. Simpson trial in terms of the coverage?
Well, you know, after you introduced me on stage at CrimeCon a few months back, that's exactly kind of what I addressed, this idea of the social media effect of all of this. Because as prominent, if you will, as the O.J. Simpson case was, the social media was not around. We didn't have Twitter. We didn't have those sort of things. And by the time the Arias trial rolled around, we got to a point now where people could watch the trial live on their cell phones. They could sit at the office right and watch the trial or check in on the trial. So you had the media coverage, you had the social media coverage, and it was almost nonstop, Jim. I mean, being a local resident of Arizona, too, I mean, I could turn on my TV in the morning and see what had happened the day before and what was going to happen the next day. There was just a complete saturation of the case from both a media and a social media perspective.
I noticed another very extremely unusual aspect in a death penalty case was the fact that the defendant took the stand, and Jodi Arias was on the stand for, was she on 17 or 18 days?
People tell me 18 days. I wasn't counting at the time. My focus was elsewhere, but the general consensus seems to be 18 days. And it is true that I have had major felony cases that begin and end in less than 18 days. But, you know, in a death penalty case, obviously the stakes are the ultimate price is being asked to be imposed. So they do not move at a rapid pace.
Right. But in this case, the fact that Jodi was on the stand for 18 days, to me, that was the most fascinating thing behaviorally. And the fact that we could day in and day out, hour after hour after hour, see her, her composure, her ability to be sort of hyper-vigilant in terms of language and hyper-precise. And I believe she did an amazing job not only talking circles around the prosecutor who was cross-examining her, but also pushing all of his buttons and making it very difficult for him to have a good flow of his questioning. And I think that may be why it dragged out for so long. What do you think?
Well, I mean, that's part of it. Certainly when we talk about these 18 days, you know, I don't know how many of those that I'm responsible for with the direct examination. But getting a jury, you know, we talk about the ultimate goal of capital defense being to spare the client's life. Getting the jury to understand the client is of utmost importance to me. And obviously, Mr. Martinez has a different agenda. But I think it was obviously that led Jim, the kind of discourse between those two led to a lot of extra time, because there was that constant frustration. There was that constant battle, if you will.
Laura, did you get a chance to see any of her testimony at trial?
I saw a little bit of it, yes. I mean, I remember the trial at the time, but I just looked back at some of the things that are on YouTube. I mean, she certainly seems well composed, and there were elements when she was questioned about the voicemails, for example, that were left, and her account of what happened, which seemed to change across the years, of her saying what happened and how it happened and why it happened. And I think, was it Kirk? I mean, correct me if I misunderstood this, but was it 2 years in that she actually, the defense around it being domestic violence related, that it was self-defense? Was it 2 years later that that was offered in defense?
I would say that is approximately correct. I cannot remember, it being so many years ago now, I cannot remember when I filed my amended notice of defenses to include self-defense, which Arizona rules require us to do. But that was done in probably 2 years, is probably a fair approximation of when I did that.
So I did see the parts where Mr. Martinez was asking her specifically about why she left the voicemails. And you know, there were a number of voicemails, I recall, that were left on his phone after the murder. And she concedes quite a lot of what he says, in that she is trying to direct police attention elsewhere, away from her. Which I thought was curious, because I have worked quite a lot of domestic violence cases, and certainly those where battered women kill, and you know, they kill because they've been abused over a period of time. And this case felt quite different to many others that I've seen, not just because of the television aspect, but the way how composed she was, the cleaning up, the voicemails, the things that happened that seemed to be quite planned. And even in her responses, she seems very well put together and composed. I don't know if you can comment on any of those things in particular.
I will say this. I'm obviously, I cannot match my expertise on domestic violence against yours. But what I would say is that three separate domestic violence experts believed that she was a victim of domestic violence. That is the evidence that was put forward at trial.
And may I ask if they interviewed her specifically, or how did they arrive at those determinations? Just because I didn't see the whole trial, I don't recall.
Well, yeah, there was testing and interviews. There were each, you know, when a capital defendant is put on trial, a thorough psychological evaluation is done that cover many aspects of just general psychological health, as well as specific issues related to the case. And both sides have the opportunity to put the client or the defendant through those kind of testing and those kind of clinical interviews.
Right. So from interviews and from her, no doubt, talking about specific events or situations in terms of what her account of the relationship was.
Well, be mindful as well, there was also numerous written communications, text messages, those sort of things that were also considered by the experts.
But I recall from your book and just from some of the accounts that you talked about her deeply disturbed behavior. And I don't know if you can say anything about that, of your interaction, in terms of what you meant by that, whether you can explain it a little bit.
Well,
was that in terms of the trial or
specifically what you're referring to? I talk about the disconnect in her behavior during our first meeting, about how it was like chatting at Starbucks as opposed to a person being in jail facing felony murder charges, and felony murder, first degree murder, and capital murder charges. So I talk about that a little bit. I don't recall referring to her behaviors as deeply disturbing, or her mental state is deeply disturbing.
But I also read from her, Travis's best friend, that he claims that she was stalking Travis, and that there was a pattern of behavior of her stalking him, and that there were tires slashed and her turning up unannounced, and that actually it was the other way round. And of course, you know, I can only go on what I've seen and what I've read, and I certainly, you were there and you prepared the file and put the case on her behalf, but it seemed to be that there are two very different accounts. One that's hers, that where she's saying that she's a victim of domestic violence, and of course I work with many victims, and then there are others. Of course, Travis isn't here to give his account, but there are others who claim that she was the one who wouldn't let the relationship end.
You said I was the one there preparing the file, but I think it's important to take a step back when we talk about making this assessment, and whether it's myself as someone who had practiced law for a long time and dealt with domestic violence, or you as an expert, I think you would have to concede that the only people that truly know whether domestic violence happened in that relationship was Mr. Alexander and Miss Arias. They're the only ones that truly know. I think you would have to concede as well that friends and family don't often know the full extent of the relationship that is happening behind closed doors when there is domestic violence. And the other thing I would say, while I'm on a personal level no fan of Miss Arias, we have to say that there was also behaviors that were going on between Mr. Alexander and Miss Arias, mainly sexual behaviors, that those people that were vouching for Mr. Alexander also did not know about.
Did you kill Travis Alexander?
Yes, I did. He called me a skank. He called me porn star.
It's you. I wanted to cover you up because... That's you, all of you.
Some of our Facebook listeners are very curious about what you just said about, you know, not being a fan of hers, and your oft-quoted statement in your closing about, you know, not liking her most days. Can you just go into that, your experience of her, and how you've dealt with the aftermath of this trial and all that stuff?
Well, boy, that is a big question, I guess. I could probably go on for an hour, but we'd hear Jim snoring in the background. let me say it as briefly as possible. I think a lot of people that are watching trials have a couple perceptions that are more accurately characterized as misperceptions. Well, the audience misperception relates to, in terms of liking a client, a lot of people believe that an attorney has some kind of personal liking for the client, and that's not necessarily true as well. I mean, going back to one of the earlier questions, I'm assigned the case. I have no idea, little idea who this person is. That is part of my job. And as I should say, I'm a stern opponent of the death penalty, which is why I was doing that work. So
I agree with you.
In many ways, I was also I was mindful of the fact that regardless, my personal opinion of Miss Arias or her story or anything is irrelevant. It is the jury's that is relevant. But if I had any personal opinion that is at least parsed based on a overall objection to the death penalty, the idea that when compared to cases in Maricopa County, I don't believe that Ms. Arias' situation made her worthy of the death penalty and the choice to select the death penalty when compared to other cases. Now, to address the second part of your question, I think it was how I deal with the fallout on a personal level. I mean, this was almost a 6-year ordeal for me. It was over in April of 2015 after being assigned the case in August of 2009 and going through the trial and the retrial of the sentencing phase. It basically consumed my practice. I had very little of any other clientele because I couldn't really dedicate myself to their cases during these time periods. So in April 2015, I experienced something I'd never experienced before. On a professional level, I had nothing to do. I had no cases. I was going for a run the next day, and I realized I did not have to run off to court. I did not have to run off to the office. It felt uneasy, but I made the choice to try to do what I can because the case was all consuming and I missed a lot of weekends and evenings with my wife and vacations and et cetera, et cetera. So I made the decision to kind of take a little bit of a sabbatical. People had asked me about my weight loss. And so I decided, well, I would try to help people by giving them a guide to how I lost the 75 plus pounds between the two trials, and that I would take some time off. And then in September of 2015, late August, early September, that is when I found the inflammation under my arm and eventually learned that I had stage 3 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So then I went from battling to save Miss Arias's life on a worldwide stage to battling my own in a very private way until I went public with it in a couple months later.
Yeah, well, Kirk, as you know, I can relate directly to that because I had the same discovery back in 2004 and ended up having a autologous bone marrow transplant, stem cell bone marrow transplant, and made it through. So I'm really happy that you made it through that fight and that you're doing so well.
Well, likewise, Jim. I know it's being a cancer survivor gives us probably a bond that we probably both rather not have, but here we are, and it's certainly been a life-changing experience in terms of motivating me to really examine what I wanted to do with my life and how I wanted to live the rest of my life on this planet, however many days or years that might be.
That's right, and I just want to know your secret, though.
Yeah, you look amazing. You look very different from the pictures that I saw.
But how do you keep your hair? I mean, mine didn't come back. What's up with that?
Well, you know, what's so funny is, and I'll be brief, I started shaving my head in law school. And after the first trial and I lost all the weight, I finally gave in to my wife to stop shaving my head. And I grew it out and lost the weight. But then when I started with cancer, I shaved my head because I decided I wanted to take it myself instead of letting cancer take my hair.
I did the same thing.
The funny part was that it never really fell out. The nurse, about halfway through, she said, "You never lost your hair, did you?" And I said, "No, not really." Wow. And it came back a little grayer, but it did come back. So I don't know what the secret is. I guess I got lucky in that regard with my hair.
All right, great.
I recall it brings back a funny memory of the media fervor around the case because there was actually on Dr. Drew's show when he had a show on HLN where they actually talked about my weight loss and my hair when the contemplation was whether or not I was using taxpayer money to fund gastric bypass and hair implants. That is an example of the fervor around this case that was so surreal to me because we had such a tragedy, yet somehow my hair and my weight loss was of such import.
Anyway, in terms of sort of the repercussions of the case and so forth, you decided to write a book about your interactions and your representation of Jody Arias. What was the reason that you wrote that book?
And when I learned I had cancer, I was doing a bit of writing myself for therapeutic reasons because it was such a strained and stressful experience. And when the cancer diagnosis came in, I was basically advised that I had approximately a 70% chance of beating it, but only, you know, that 30% stood out as glaring to me because a 30% chance of not making it and staring your mortality in the face tends to alter one's viewpoint. I began to be mindful of the interview Miss Arias gave between the sentencing phase and the penalty phase during the first trial, where she stated a lot of things about myself that were not accurate. And I talk in the book a little bit about the threat she made to ruin my career if I did not comply with her wishes. And so I thought, to make a long story short, I thought that if I was going to depart this planet, I was not going to do so without responding to her words. And I believe to this day that my response to Miss Arias was ethically proper, given the things she said in that interview. However, the state bar did not see it that way. And rather than contest it, I chose to not accept a suspension and, in fact, request disbarment because I had no desire after surviving cancer to go back and practice law.
That's certainly an interesting twist of fate there because, in a way, Jody did manage to sort of end your legal career. And it's a shame because I think what you were doing was trying to save her life. It's kind of ironic, isn't it?
I guess now I'm to the point where I don't look back. I look forward and I think about my life coaching practice and all the lawyers that are overstressed and what that did to me. And I feel very called to do all I can to help in that regard. So that's my focus. And I feel very comfortable in that mission today.
There's a question that's much broader, I guess, Kirk, just because you've gone through such a life-changing experience. And, you know, I'm glad you're still on the planet and, you know, to survive that, not just your experience at this trial, but to survive cancer, you know, congratulations. And I really mean that because you were looking, obviously, potentially not being on this planet. And so I love the fact that you're just looking forward rather than backwards. But I wonder, just to look backwards for a moment, of what advice would you give your younger self?
Wow.
You stumped him, Laura.
I said it was slightly off, you know, broader and off topic, but I'm just curious.
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words as a precursor to this question. And I don't know that I really know the answer to that question because I think everything we do in our past builds us up to who we are now. And I don't really think I would want to change anything. I guess in one sense, I would say I wish I would have been more, because I first tried to withdraw from this case back in 2011 and the public defender's office had signed off on this. So it would have been nice if that that happened, but so be it. I mean, like I say, I guess I just don't frame things that way because who knows if that would have happened, some other attorney would have had the task fall on them. So if fate had it for me to be the person.
So you wouldn't have, I guess an extension of that is, would you have done anything differently, you know, in relation to this in particular then? Or would you have done it all the same if it was in your gift?
Well, like I say, I don't tend to look back and I consider, although this is a tragedy, I think it would have been deepened if Miss Arias was sentenced to death. So ultimately, whatever we want to say about the Arias case is that from a legal perspective and a sentencing perspective, I think it was the appropriate outcome and it was, in essence, a victory.
Kirk, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you some specific questions, though, about, you know, given the defense that you put forward and the facts of the case, the batter and domestic partner situation that you talk about. How does the fact that Jody dyed her hair, rented a car, got all these gas cans filled with gas so she can make the trip without stopping at a gas station, how does that all square with the situation in which she's actually presenting herself as the victim of domestic violence? All that was a precursor to the fateful day where she ended up killing Travis.
Well, there's a lot involved in your question, but what I would do, first of all, is go back to this idea in terms of the defense. In a capital case in particular, a client talks to experts and those things are disclosed to both sides. In that essence, the client tells the story. That becomes a matter of the client deciding this is what happened. So to answer your question, I'm not necessarily saying that it does. I'm saying that, you know, I laid out in my book the theory that I had that this was a spur of the moment killing that happened, you know, that it was more akin to a manslaughter or second degree murder than a first degree murder. That was my personal belief. Miss Arias had her story.
And I'll just say, as from my point of view, and again, I wasn't involved in the case, and I only could see the trial. I didn't see every part of the trial, but I think I watched a lot of her 18 days on the stand. That was the most important for me in terms of from a behavioral perspective. But from my point of view, I do believe, although I don't believe in the death penalty, I do believe that all those behaviors I just mentioned, changing her appearance, renting a car, and getting gas cans so that she can make the trip there and back without having to stop and make a record of her trip, I think all those are indicators that it wasn't a last-minute decision, that there was certainly some premeditation. And whether or not she intended to kill him or scare the shit out of him, that was a premeditative, those were premeditative moves that that I certainly, you know, as an investigator would have opined that way on had I been called to the stand.
Well, let me speak to that if I could. I don't think that some of the facts you're citing are as definitive as maybe you believe them to be.
Okay.
There was a car rental agent that testified that her hair was blonde, yet there were other pictures demonstrative of the fact that it wasn't dying back and forth. So I think that was an issue. My guess would be that him being shown a driver's license picture that was blonde or induced the belief that she was blonde. We saw the pictures on the day of the killing that she had darker hair.
Mm-hmm.
To speak to your other point, I think the gas cans is one of the biggest red herrings in the case because she did buy them with a credit card. And if you were doing it in a covert nature, you wouldn't do that.
Was the smartest criminal, but
here's the thing that I think, and this is kind of what I laid out in my closing argument, and I'll just take the position in essence that I took in my closing argument, again, putting my personal beliefs aside, Jim. There is great deliberation and planning attributed to Miss Arias, but also at the same time, what we're saying is that there is also instances of vast stupidity, which may be true, but seems to me to be a little bit contradictory. The other thing I would say to your point, Jim, in terms of all this is even if we were to accept the premise that she went to the house with the idea of committing this murder and bought the gas cans and the hair and all that stuff, even if I were to accept all of that, we have to still say that we have to account for those some 12 hours that they were together and her failure to commit that murder. One can go to someone's house, plan to commit a murder, not commit it, and not be guilty of any crime. So it could very well be the case that you are absolutely correct, but I would say that the amount of time she spent there stands in contrast to the idea that this was a covert mission with exact pre-planning that wasn't executed the moment that she walked into his home.
Well, and I guess that would come down to what the plan was. And I will say, though, that I've in my position as an FBI agent and FBI profiler, I've come across literally thousands of cases in which somebody who was intelligent, and I would put Jodi Arias at the high end. I believe she was highly intelligent, yet she was not criminally experienced. Although you can think about things when you haven't committed crimes over and over and over again, during that time, your MO usually changes based on the things that go right and things that go wrong. So this being a first-time event for Jodi Arias, I would not expect her to be criminally sophisticated or criminally experienced, and therefore certain things she may not think about. So it comes across as you said, as maybe stupidity or ignorance, but what it really is lack of experience in terms of committing crimes and what can actually become evidence. They think about some things because those are theoretically in their brain about what they have to do. But, you know, and if her plan was to lull him into a sense of complacency, then maybe that does explain the 12 hours. But I don't know exactly where the gun was or how it ended up coming out when it did. But clearly, we all know the result of that. And It's unfortunate, obviously, that, as you called it, this is a terrible tragedy because a young person, you know, Travis, was pretty brutally killed. And Jodi Arias, who maybe she did have some mental issues, maybe she was untreated for certain things, and maybe she was going through a whole bunch. And again, her life will be spent behind bars. So nobody wins in this at all.
No, ultimately that is true. There is no winners, and that's like I say, the ultimate tragedy. There's a lot of people that take joy in her demise and enjoy hating her. But I just think, you know, if we step back, the reason you hate her and the reason for her demise is because a beloved young man was killed. So I don't think there should be any joy taken in any of this.
The court finds the mitigation presented is not sufficiently substantial to call for leniency and that a natural life sentence is appropriate. It is ordered the defendant shall be incarcerated in the Department of Corrections for the rest of her natural life with no possibility of parole.
I must be one of the few people on the planet who'd never heard of this case. I mean, I don't know what I was doing during those years. Maybe I was breastfeeding multiple children. I don't know what, but I never heard of it. And so it's been very fascinating in the lead up to this interview to do all this research and learn about Jodi, but also to learn about the victim, Travis Alexander. And I know that our listeners want to know when your second book is coming out, if there is one in the making.
That is the question I get more often than not. My first book, I should mention, since we've been talking about my books, is Trapped with Miss Arias. It is part one of three, just as a precursor to your question, for those who don't understand. And in that book, I talked about writing two more books. At this point in time, I do not, I'm not prepared to make any announcements about any of that yet. But people can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Nurmi Unchained. My website now is nurmiunchained.com. Especially for those attorneys out there who might be feeling a little stressed, I'm going to have a book coming out, an e-book coming out related to some of the things I learned when fighting cancer and dealing with stress. But that'll also be the source of where any announcements come as well. They'll probably come through Twitter or be posted on my website.
I just had a question about the letter that she wrote, the 12-page letter that she also wrote about, as you know, you were trying to recuse yourself and didn't want to be in the position that you were in. But I also just read this 12-page letter that she wrote asking for you to be withdrawn and for a new public defender. And I guess your book is the answer, is that right, to the points that she makes in that letter?
Partial, and thank you for bringing that up, because I didn't bring it up when I talked about her interviews. I also talked about interviews she did between the sentencing phase and the, or excuse me, between the guilt phase and the sentencing phase of the first trial. And she also raised concerns of that nature in this 12-page. It was also a response to those things as well.
And so what she was saying, that for 5 months you didn't talk to each other. Is that a true say? I mean, is that fact? Or is that a stretch in terms of, you know, why would she sort of put that in this 12-page letter? I'm just trying to understand her mindset.
Right. Well, I don't want some of those, the things are surrounding that, and the record that was made is under seal. So I can't fully respond to that. But I will say, obviously, the judge ruled against her motion.
And why do you think that was, Kirk? I mean, the judge, with both of you saying that you didn't want to, you know, you didn't want to represent and be the public defender, she wanted you to withdraw. Can you say anything about the judge's decision? Why did they deny the change in representation?
Well, I can say from a legal standpoint, a client who is not hiring their own counsel is not entitled to counsel their own choosing, only competent counsel. The flip side of that being kind of goes back to what I said before. The fact that an attorney may or may not, their personal feelings towards their client is completely irrelevant. I could not go up and say, Judge, you know what? I just don't like this guy. I don't like his name. I don't like everything about him, and just be withdrawn from the case. My duty is to advance the case and represent the defendant, not like them.
Right.
So it's not a legally operative fact whether or not I like Miss Arias.
I guess, I mean, there was some suggestion that she wanted to represent herself. Is that right?
She did for a period of time, for a couple of weeks, perhaps.
I mean, that seems, is that something that's quite rare, Jim? Just, you know, on your side of, you know, I rarely see that unless it's actually the other way around, if someone who's trying to use power and control in a courtroom. But what's your view on that?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a very common saying in the law among lawyers that anyone who represents themselves has a fool for a client. And that's because you certainly can't adequately represent yourself. I've heard it a number of times, particularly when you have sort of genius defendants in who are very controlling. They don't want to put their lives in the hands of other people. They believe they are the most brilliant and most capable. And there are a number of serial killers who have done that. For example, James DeBartolaven was a serial killer who had a IQ in the 170s, and he represented himself. But he did get convicted. He did end up getting put in jail forever. So he may have had a fool for a client. But Laura, I want to engage you a little bit with Kirk about the whole concept of, you know, this just in-depth or kind of frenzied media coverage and all the curiosity around Jody Arias. And Kirk, you mentioned hate. People hate her. This is something that, Laura, you've talked about before, about how women in particular get aggressively hated in situations like this, or even when they're the victim of a crime. And we saw it, for example, in the Meredith Kircher case against Amanda Knox. And it was literally vilifying the female who was involved in the case. In that particular case, somebody who was completely innocent who got involved in that case. But this hatred, do you think that had something to do with it? The fact that she was a woman and she was so hated?
I mean, it certainly seems that, you know, she was hated. She was an attractive female, or is an attractive female. And those two things in and of themselves, you know, and it being a rare thing, as Kirk said right from the start, a capital crime, she is the defendant. You've got a male victim. And I have to say, you know, there's so little said about him in particular. The focus seems to be on her. And I know with our conversation, it's on her because we're talking with you, Kirk, and trying to understand what was going on. But Travis Alexander, you know, was the true victim here. But she, yes, talks about the hatred that she feels, but from other people. But she also talks about a lot of love that she gets too from people. And she is on Twitter, or somebody representing her is on Twitter. And I just looked at some of the strange and interesting things that have gone on with this case. Much of it is driven by her. And so on the one hand, yes, I do think that she was vilified right from the start without people knowing the true facts of what went on. But I think there was also another part to this, that she really courted all of the public attention to the point that I haven't seen before, actually, which is why, you know, I was asking you the 48 hours and all the TV interviews that she's done from prison and in between. I've certainly not seen someone caught quite as much, whether male or female, media attention, and she certainly seems to thrive off of that. That's my own interpretation of what's going on. So I think, you know, she is courting a lot of this media attention. Not that people deserve to be hated, but so much of it was driven by her, was it not?
I will say, you know, I was having a conversation with someone the other day and talking about just the sexism element and putting the courting in the media aside. But I do think, for example, if you walk down the street and ask people who James Holmes was, the case was pending at the same time Miss Arias' case, where more people would know Miss Arias than Mr. Holmes, who killed a lot more people and did a lot more damage. If we just talk about the amount of murders that took place, and there could be numerous others with long criminal histories, and You know, I've had other cases of domestic violence where the man killed the woman and the attention was not as significant. So putting the courting of the media aside, I think certainly that is an element there, and her attractiveness as well, because anyone, Laura, I could say could court the media, but the media doesn't have to answer that call. And the media answered that call for specific reasons. And I think a lot of those reasons might have to do with her gender and or her perceived attractiveness.
That's a very valid point. And I certainly don't disagree with that. But this was also a trial that was largely based on a lot of sexual imagery and content as well, wasn't it? And you know, I don't disagree with the fact that I do feel that there is a incongruence in the way that the media report when it is a female defendant in particular. But I still feel that there were very specific things that she did that courted that attention. And, you know, she wore the survivor t-shirt in court as well. And she's been selling art and her hair and all sorts of things that continue to get attention. And I think, you know, my own interpretation is that she is somebody who really does like attention, and not just likes attention, craves attention. And of course, some of the tools that she does have is that she is a very attractive young woman and is articulate and intelligent as well. And so, yes, to your point, the media don't have to answer those calls, but she is unusual. Whereas Amanda Knox, who we've covered before, and of course we've talked about, most people don't even know Meredith Kircher's name. You know, there was a very significant interest in her where the media, almost certainly one paper in particular, even before the trial, was saying that she was guilty and naming her Foxy Knoxie, and everyone wanted to believe she was guilty right from the start. Whereas conversely, everyone wanted to believe O.J. Simpson was innocent. And I think that's where you see this polarization, and certainly how women are treated very differently. But she is quite different to many other cases that I've seen. And of course, I didn't work on it. So, you know, I have to immediately make that clear that I'm not in the detail of it as you were. And I think Jim certainly paid close attention to it. But there's certainly some real anomalies with her and the way that she presents. And certainly her change of accounts and things that I think courted a lot of attention on her, as well as the fact that the way she looked and was articulate and intelligent and really was trying to drive a lot of interest in herself.
Well, and I speak to address part of what you say. I speak to, in my book, the part one of Trapped with Miss Arias, I speak to a cult-like leader personality that she has, because when we talk about courting in the media, you talk about people following her on Twitter and paying attention to her. There is no mandate for people to do that. They choose to do that. And I think that personality of hers, that cult of personality, is part of what draws that in. And I try to explain that viewpoint a little bit in my book as well.
And what's the name of the book again, Kirk?
The name of the book is Trapped with Miss Arias, From Getting the File to Being Ready for Trial. It kind of goes into the backstory. I talk about getting the file. I talk about meeting Miss Arias, and I talk about some of the things that happened to the lead up of the case, the change of counsel. A lot of people want to know why it took so long to get to trial. So I kind of outline all of that, my attempts to get off the case, et cetera, et cetera, and try to give people a bit of a background on capital representation in general and what the ultimate goal is of capital representation. Going back to something we said very early on, this idea that attorneys in this situation like their clients or agree with their stories or what they're saying, but really to kind of explain the job they have to do in the context of that and what the ultimate goal of that job is, with the assumption and the reality that when there is a victim who has been killed viciously and somebody who's facing the death penalty, where there can be really no true winner.
All right. Well, our listeners can learn more of the details from Kirk Nurmi's book, Trapped with Miss Arias, and we hope you pick it up and read it so you can find out everything that Kirk had to say on this topic. We thank you very much, Kirk, for coming today and speaking with us on Real Crime Profile and giving us your insights to this very interesting and disturbing and tragic case.
Well, thank you, Jim, and I appreciate the conversation with everyone. I guess I neglected to say my book is available on Amazon. It is not in bookstores, but available exclusively on Amazon as well. So those seeking more knowledge can find it there. And like I say, I really appreciate the discourse today and the respectful nature that it was conducted in.
Thank you so much.
Kirk. We've appreciated you as well. And is there anything else that you want to say or want to make representation on that we haven't covered?
Well, you know, I guess the one thing, and Laura, you would probably agree with me on this. One of the other motivations, I guess, that went unstated for writing this book was the idea of looking beyond the sensational aspects of this case towards the tragedy, but also towards preventing of further tragedies. And making this relationship and how it ended illustrative of the fact that if people are not happy with each other or unhappy with how they're being treated in a relationship, that they need to be able to distance themselves from those unhealthy relationships and these toxic bonds. Because what we've seen here play out on June 4th, 2008 was ultimately a manifestation of what could happen when people don't get away from each other. We see the things that he called her in the text messages, vice versa, how they were to each other. People in that situation, I hope, will take away from this case, not the sexual aspects of it, but that lesson that they need to get away into healthier relationships.
I think that's a good point, talking about healthy relationships, and we do cover it in other pods. And actually, it's a subject, Jim and Lisa, I want to return to and maybe bring someone like Gavin De Becker on and talk a little bit more about that and, you know, separation and so on and so forth. So I agree. So thank you very much, Kirk. I've appreciated talking with you. And there's so much more I could ask you. And I'm sure Jim and Lisa feel the same, but we're mindful of your time. So maybe we'll do a
part two someday.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much, Kirk.
All right. Thanks. Well, thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Real Crime Profile.
Hey, it's Lisa Z from RCP. Longtime Real Crime Profile listeners know that we are big fans of the podcast Truth and Justice, hosted by our good friend Bob Ruff. Through Truth and Justice, Bob has investigated the Adnan Syed case in season one, then moved on to work for the Innocence Project of Texas on four other cases in seasons two through four. Well, now Bob may be taking on the most complicated and controversial case yet as he investigates what is known as the West Memphis Three. Now, as our listeners know, the Real Crime Profile team covered this tragic case last year, but Bob is about to take it to a whole new level. This case known as the West Memphis Three has captured the attention of millions of people from around the world. To recap, on May 5th, 1993, three 8-year-old boys took off riding on their bikes together in the quiet neighborhood in West Memphis, Arkansas. After not returning home for dinner, the search began for them around 6 p.m. The next day, around 1 p.m., the boys' bodies were discovered in a shallow drainage ditch, naked and badly beaten. Investigators at the time determined that the murders had satanic cult overtones, and within weeks, three teenage boys were arrested for the crime and later convicted. 18 years later, the three were set free, but only after being forced to plead guilty, causing them to live out the rest of their lives as convicted murderers and allowing the state to maintain that the case was closed. No justice for the victims or the wrongfully convicted. Well, our friends at Truth and Justice podcast hope to change that. Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff utilizes real-time crowdsourcing to solve cold cases. Listeners don't just listen, they actually participate in the investigations. With over 30 million downloads, the Truth and Justice audience is a powerful tool for solving the unsolvable. The host, Bob Ruff, believes that through their unique crowdsourcing approach, they can finally find the truth and bring real justice to everyone involved in this tragic case. Truth and Justice is launching their reinvestigation into the West Memphis 3 case on November 5th. The series begins with episode 501. Check out the Truth and Justice podcast on iTunes, Audioboom, or your favorite podcast directory. Download episode 501, Truth and Justice, with Bob Ruff on November 5th to join in on the investigation. We wish our buddy Bob the best of luck in solving this controversial and very tragic case.
The West Memphis 3 is a case that has been picked over by literally millions of people from around the world. On May 6, 1993, the bodies of 3 8-year-old boys were discovered in a shallow drainage ditch in the transient town of West Memphis, Arkansas. These were the days of the Satanic Panic era in the United States. The murder of these 3 little boys was so shocking and so grotesque that investigators believe that they were murdered as part of a satanic cult ritual. Three teenagers, underclass and unpopular, were quickly targeted by police and arrested for the murders. The case drew international attention through a 3-part documentary called Paradise Lost, in another documentary titled West of Memphis. There was even a Hollywood movie about the case, The Devil's Knot. 18 years after their arrest, the 3 teenagers, now grown men known as the West Memphis 3, were finally set free. Jason Baldwin, Jesse Ms. Kelly, and Damian Eccles were forced to plead guilty in exchange for time served in order to avoid Damian Eccles' execution. Justice was never served in this case. The 3 live their lives today as convicted murderers. And the real killers of Stevie Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers has never been brought to justice. The Truth and Justice podcast, through a real-time crowdsourcing approach, hopes to finally change that. We are going back to ground zero to reinvestigate this case. We will attack the misconceptions, hear from new witnesses, reanalyze evidence, hear from real experts, and engage the hundreds of thousands of listeners with every skill set from around the world to dig out the truth and bring justice, real justice, to the forgotten 3. Michael, Christopher, and Stevie. The Season 5 Journey of Truth and Justice will begin on November 5th. Download episode 501 on iTunes, Audioboom, or your favorite podcast directory. Be a part of the investigation, and together, let's try to bring truth and justice to the West Memphis 3.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107 or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357,
or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the Domestic Violence Hotline on 800-799-7233.